Welcome to Key Witness, the podcast from Quakers in Britain, all about taking action for sustainability, equality and peace.
Only it isn't. It isn't Key Witness. We have a new logo and a new name. It's all changed here at Quakers in Britain. I mean, Elizabeth is still here.
Yeah.
So there is some stability in this world. And I used to do the podcast, you've probably forgotten about me. And now we've come back, we've kicked out all the other people, we've changed the name, we've taken control. Because, you know, changes in the air. Quakers have got rid of God, they've got rid of faith and practice. And so we thought, let's change everything, why not? There's no rules anymore.
Yeah, new picture, new logo.
That's how it works, right?
New music. Yeah, it's totally how it works.
That's not what happened. What happened is we decided it would be better to explore a more variety of topics and to unpack the issues of today. And we wanted to talk about, you know, stuff like nuclear weapons, peace education, demonstrations and things like that. But we also wanted to talk about community and faith and how those intersect and just random stuff that Quakers care about.
Yeah, and there's a very good reason why we're also calling it a Quaker take rather than the Quaker take, because often Quakers have more than one perspective on things, and we wanted to include different voices, talk to different people who maybe we wouldn't have naturally talked to before, and so we want to hear your take as well. So it's a Quaker take, and if you have an opinion, you have a take. So let us know what you think.
And so we are going to, in the next episode, unpack what I just said about God, because that's not true. We haven't thrown away God. So that's like a very good example of kind of thing we can explore now. What is a Quaker take on God?
We're also moving to a monthly format. So today we've got a Quaker take on peace education.
Yep, and we've got friend of the podcast, Ellis Brooks, with us.
Hey guys.
I work on peace education for Quakers in Britain.
What is a Quaker take on peace education, Ellis?
So peace education sounds like it'd be really simple, but it actually includes a lot of different things. So it's peace building, so that's like when we take action to build peace and justice in the world, whether that's the civil rights movement or whether that's something like suffrage, like what is building peace? What is building justice? But there's also the level of peacemaking, conflict resolution. So, and again, that could be just at the level between people, or it could be on a really massive issue like nuclear weapons.
So why do Quakers care about peace education?
Well, as you might know, Quakers have had their peace testimony since the 17th century, and that's manifested in lots of different ways. So in conscientious objection to war and not participating in fighting, or in their campaigning on nuclear weapons and against various wars and military interventions. But also friends came to realise that if you're going to be working for a peaceful world, you've got to do it with children and young people, because they're going to be the people who are living with it, and they have the right to have an effect on what kind of world they're living in.
Yeah. And so is this something that Quakers have been doing for a while?
Peace education has definitely been part of Quaker work since at least the 1980s, although I'm sure, I mean, in a way, it's peace education is happening all the time in lots of different forms. Lots of teachers do it, even if they wouldn't call it peace education, but Quakers got particularly active on it in the 1980s, somewhat drawing on their existing kind of experience of peacemaking in the wider world, doing mediation in international issues like Northern Ireland.
So what makes this education rather than indoctrination?
Well, that's a really big question. It has been a controversial one in the past. And what you're sort of alluding to there is that peace education has to be itself peaceful education, as in we can't coerce people into agreeing with us on any particular issue of peace. So it's more about equipping learners with the critical thinking skills and with just the facts and information to look at any question of peace or violence and work out their own moral approach to it, their own stance on it, and what they're going to do about it.
So kind of, yeah, having that thinking process, more critical thinking, letting young people think about the issues for themselves.
Quite so. It's a debate that we as a society have. Our government has it. It might happen in the pub. So it would be strange if young citizens were somehow cut out of that discussion.
Does that include interpersonal stuff as well? About?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's, and it can even be just on an internal level. How do I make peace with myself? How can I be non-violent to myself with my own thoughts or feelings? Then you ripple outwards to your relationships, your friends, your family, the people in your community, and then right out to, like, how am I making peace with someone in North Korea right now?
And it sounds like we're going to talk a little bit about that big picture stuff today, is that right?
Yeah, I think so, although you can personalise that as well. So the topic is nuclear weapons, and how do you do peace education about nuclear weapons? And you can do that, of course, in a very big issues kind of way. You can talk about the physics and the, you know, what is the megaton yield of a nuclear weapon, and how many weapons does the Trident submarine have on it? But there's also, what's your personal emotional reaction to the prospect of a weapon of mass destruction, and what are the stories of people who have experienced these weapons?
So what are the different ways that people have been exploring those topics then that isn't quite so sort of science-based?
Well, I had an amazing experience where I went to Houseman's Bookshop, a wonderful radical bookshop near Friend's house, and it was an event put on by Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND. There was a poet there called Anthony Owen. He would describe himself as a peace poet, which I think is a wonderful idea, and he was sharing his poetry, having spent a lot of time in Japan, going to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and speaking to Hibakusha, the survivors of nuclear weapons. So that's inspired a lot of poetry from him, and just hearing him speak, I was really struck that this is a very personal issue as well as a political one. And part of that workshop was also people producing their own poetry. So CND have their own peace education programme, and they have used that same creative approach. So young people do look at the facts, they do look at the politics and the history, but they also have their own personal creative response in producing poetry on these questions. And I think that helps them kind of have an emotional connection to it.
And so I think we're fortunate enough that you've managed to be talking to some of these guys for us.
Yeah, well, I collared, after that talk at the bookshop, I collared Anthony Owen and said, would you like to come and record a podcast with us? And he was really happy to. And he's joined by Owen Everett, who's the Peace Education Coordinator for CND. We also had with us Sadia Dar, who campaigns on nuclear weapons for Quakers in Britain, to talk about how we actually campaign at a political level as well on this.
Cool. So, over to you and the Owens.
Fat man awakens. Devouring breath. Birdsong sky. Skeleton city.
That was Seryu 5 from the Nagasaki Elder, a collection of poems by Anthony Owen.
Hi, Anthony.
My name's Ellis Brooks, and around me are Sadia Dar. Hi, Sadia.
Hi, Ellis.
And next to her is Owen.
Hi, Ellis. Yeah, I'm Owen. I'm the Peace Education Officer at the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
And finally, Anthony Owen.
And I'm a peace poet from Coventry.
Yeah, Anthony's a poet from Coventry, and in 2015 he travelled extensively in Japan for the centenary of the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And his works include The Dreaded Boy and The Nagasaki Elder. And Owen, you're a former Quaker peace worker as well, right?
That's correct.
So they always come back to us in the end. But now running the excellent peace education programme from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and we'll be talking about some of the excellent resources and activities that you do today. Owen and Anthony have been working together on peace education, combining their poetry talents with their teaching talents to bring the topic of nuclear weapons into school. So we're finding out more about that. But should we start with you, Anthony? How did you become a poet, first of all?
School, secondary school, I was pretty poor at formula subjects like maths, because it was right answer, wrong answer, and science. My dad was a tool maker, so he was very into measurements and mathematics, and he's quite strict with me on my schooling. And English gave me a voice. And within that voice, one day we were shown a peace education video after poetry class, which was Threads. We watched it in about 4 episodes, and it was very harrowing.
Threads, the 1980s film about a nuclear bomb falling on Sheffield. And
yeah, that's a very heavy piece of work, isn't it?
It is. That was 1985, so I was 12 years old. And they didn't edit the typical 80s. they didn't edit Threads, which was written by Barry Hines, a hugely underrated writer. At that point, there were 54,000 nuclear weapons, which is quite frightening, you know. So it stimulated my interest, really, in what happened in Hiroshima. Obviously, this was in Sheffield, Threads.
Yes.
Like working class people like my mum and my dad. I could relate to these people because they looked like me. I felt guilty because I didn't feel the same way about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I revisited it that later as an adult, where I could articulate, you know, after 5 collections of poetry that have been published now, I could articulate it and revisit it. And it was very harrowing to write.
So your path into poetry was kind of a path into peace all at the same time. It wasn't sort of two separate things.
Yeah, it was a seed of social consciousness, really, because poetry's got to say something or it says nothing, in my opinion. How can a child be wrong? I was pure. So the first thing, really, I felt was that I was reading a lot of Shakespeare and a lot of sort of poetry with men in tights. all men, no women. It's terrible. Yeah. And I just felt, no, this poetry's got to say something important, surely, right? And that instinct never left me.
Mm. Owen? That's a really good mandate for peace education, actually, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. When we do our teacher training sessions, I'm always encouraged by how passionate teachers are from whatever subject, because we do them for a wide range of teaching subjects, in getting their students to engage with issues. It may not be specifically within their subject curriculum, it may actually be something that comes up in the classroom, in form or in the corridor, but teachers do really believe that's important. They do have this sort of greater vision of education that goes well beyond, you know, exam sort of league tables and other constraints that are placed on them.
Anthony, could we hear another one of your poems?
So we were super excited, weren't we, Sadia, that Anthony's actually showed up today with a brand new poem.
We were.
It's basically called Enola Gay. Not many people have written poems actually on the plane that dropped the bomb. So. Mm.
And the name sounds quite innocuous, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously the mother of Colonel Paul Tibbetts, who was the sort of chief pilot of the Enola Gay, and he dropped a bomb. He named the, a lot, that was quite a big thing, named the plane after someone. Like the Nagasaki bomb was named after Churchill, fat man. Enola Gay, yeah. That was his mother. A symbol of life.
Yeah. Shall we hear it?
It all makes sense now, for Sky is a storyteller. Enola in the mirror reads as alone. So let us reflect then. Let us be gay for a moment and think of a survivor dying peacefully. Picture this. Thousands saw Enola Gay, like a silver crucifix left on a crushed blue velvet sky. Capture this. Bamboo spears, some unsharpened. Children used them to stir clothes in carbolic water. They only pierced sky, and smoke made flutes of them. Oh, Enola Gay, you a mother who made children and boysenberry pie. One summer day, you were the other who took children and lifted them to sky. Oh, Enola Gay, your son wrote your name as doomsday on a silver-crested bird. You danced as a naked flame and candled flesh till cicadas chirred. It all makes sense now, for black rain was war bathing in its madness. When I think of Enola Gay, she was a mother with a crucifix. It faced the right way up, and like the devil who stole it. Oh, Enola Gay, another Hibakusha has died today. She was a little girl who used to wait for her mama and say, the soul of my bloodline is in the sky, and so each night I pray.
Anthony, you're wearing today the Cross of Nails as a necklace from Coventry. Was it the canon of Coventry who put the nails together?
It's Jack Forbes. Jack Forbes was just an ordinary man that just saw two beams that fell together in the shape of a cross, and he basically bound them together as a symbol of peace, not hatred, forgiveness.
And that same image of a crucifix is in the poem as well, isn't it?
Yeah, the Enola Gay, because obviously the aluminium shining in the blue sky of the Enola Gay, and it was a very hot day in Hiroshima, obviously it was August. It just shone and glowed like a crucifix, and the chemtrails that it was leaving looked like a necklace, but it was an upside down necklace. So I'm trying to say that Christian men playing God, creating hell, dropping it 5,000 degrees Celsius at surface temperature is not a Christian thing to do. It is a devilish thing to do.
Mm. There's such powerful imagery, so many ways to look at events on one day.
Well, the capture this is almost sort of commenting on a hope for school children more than anyone, to give them an opportunity to create their own selfie, their own photograph, their own image of Hiroshima beyond the safe distance of the mushroom cloud that we saw from, I think the plane was called Necessary Evil, which was the camera plane. So it was more than just the Enola Gay. There was a reconnaissance plane as well, and the Great Artiste, which is an observation plane. This was planned. You know? It wasn't just, let's just drop the bomb in a really bad mood. It was planned, the time was planned, darkness imminent. From 8:15 onwards.
The words "captured this" made me think about what we here at the Quakers are currently doing with regards to, well, since the adoption of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Yeah.
And ICAN winning the Nobel Peace Prize. We've been working with JPIT, the Joint Public Issues Team, to put pressure on the UK government to sign the treaty.
That's really positive.
Yes, hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really positive just to see that action, you know.
Yeah, and that's, it's a really accessible one for young people. Anthony, in 2015, you travelled to Japan.
That came about from, really, a gentleman called John Hartley, who's in his 80s. He went over to Hiroshima in his 50s. He's friends with my auntie, who was an evacuee from Coventry. Her house was bombed twice. And basically, she introduced me to John. He had a thriving network of friends in Hiroshima. And subsequently, he introduced me to them. They invited me over with a very full itinerary, which included meeting survivors, going to places like Honkawa School, where 400 children died, and really showing me the Daiki Museum as such, which Hiroshima is a very much a two-mile-wide museum, really.
And obviously, Coventry has its own experience of a war and conflict, so there's a real kind of resonance between the two cities, I guess.
That's right, yeah. I mean, about 40,000 houses were destroyed, 568 people died, and nothing like Dresden or Hamburg, but there's an image that I always remember seeing of a postman with his letters the following morning, and he's at the house which he was supposed to deliver the letters to, and it was all bombed. And there were people like my auntie that were taken away from a parent. Well, her mum actually, because her dad was abroad fixing Lancasters in Algeria. So the long and short of it was she was displaced. No different, I should say, to a refugee. Evacuee is just a different word for it. And going back to the exposition, we have to find, when we look at a Syrian or when we look at somebody else, like the massive breakup of India after World War II, we have to try and attach empathy. And that has to come from somewhere else than Hollywood and Brad Pitt playing the part of a Russian or playing the part of a good old American or something. It's got to be owned by the invisible people, the overlooked people as well.
Yeah, and Owen, peace education is a way to build that empathy.
I think that's absolutely key to it. When we do these teacher training sessions, and I ask them, what is the point of looking at controversial issues? Isn't it just, you know, too much hassle? Isn't it too problematic? And of course, I'm, you know, saying that facetiously, and they do respond almost always with empathy as one of the key reasons. Encouraging students to accept that people will always disagree with them, and it's very useful to understand where someone's coming from in order to try and find some common ground.
Aaron, how did you get involved in that?
It was a mixture of great good fortune on my part and a desire to do education work and an enjoyment of seeing critical thinking develop among young people. So initially, after university, I was lucky enough to, as you mentioned, be one of the UK-based Quakers peace workers for a year. And one of my two placement organisations, Forces Watch, amongst other things, looks at the role of the armed forces in the UK. But I was also going into schools and delivering workshops, getting kids to basically give their opinion on things like a Navy recruitment advert. What were the messages? What was being left out? What did they think of it? Would they consider joining the armed forces? Etc, etc. And I hugely enjoyed that sort of nature of work and happened to be in the right place at the right time when this job came up a year or so later.
How are you finding it?
I'm finding it fantastic. I described it on my application form as my dream job, and I would stand by that. And to see a kind of immediate impact, either through teachers being trained up to deliver some of our lessons, or students taking on one of our workshops and, for example, putting President Truman on trial for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or writing haikus or senryu of their own. Anything like that is just very sort of inspiring to witness. And if at the end of the day we have empowered them to sort of feel more articulate about these issues, whether they agree with the aims of C&D or not, that's not what's important, but it's really sort of nurturing that seed of critical thinking and a sense that they have as much right to an opinion on these issues as anyone else, that it's far too important to be left to politicians.
Yeah, yeah. Young people are citizens now. It's not that they're future citizens.
Well said.
And I think Truman on Trial is a really good example, because you are actually giving them decision-making power, right? So the young people in the room are getting the evidence.
A short time ago, an American aeroplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
They know what Truman said his aims were, what other people said his aims were, they know what actually happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so that information then is informing a real decision. And you actually have the trial, right?
Exactly. So this is one of our 5 teaching packs, all of which we provide free to teachers and schools. And we've just updated it with lots of new material, some exciting new activities. And it has 4 subject pathways. So we see religious education, history, citizenship and English kind of meeting together.
Mm.
And in the sort of flagship lesson, the mock trial, Truman is represented on the sort of PowerPoint, and the students take on the roles of barristers, witnesses and ultimately jurors. Also, in some cases, we have one of them play the judge, and they do essentially put him on trial, arguing both sides, of course, and looking at the evidence that we've kind of provided from eyewitness testimonies, fictitious, I should say, but based loosely on real people, and historical evidence and some of the historical debate. And it's a really engaging kind of role-play-esque way to decide for themselves whether it was right or not, and we sort of discuss often with them the kind of issue of war crimes and the fact that, of course, historically speaking, there was no equivalent for the Western Allies of the Nuremberg trials or the Tokyo trials. So we're kind of essentially going against history and saying, what if actually Truman had been put on trial? What would have happened? What is culpability? What does it look like?
What is justice?
Indeed.
So how often does Truman get convicted?
Overwhelmingly, he does get convicted. I've been in the job just over a year, and every time but one, I believe, he has been convicted, usually, if not unanimously, by a large majority of the jury. And I should clarify that the students playing the witnesses become the jurors at the end, and we ask them to step out of their shoes. So they have been role-playing as a Nagasaki victim a US civilian, and they step out of that, think, okay, based on what I've heard, and they would have filled in a sheet during the trial on each witness and so on, what do I actually think? I would say it's a really interesting distinction to other activities that we do with students looking at the UK's nuclear weapons. So we look at Trident and the arguments for and against, and almost always students vote with a significant majority in favour of keeping Trident, and yet at the same time they would almost always say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were wrong. So this kind of disconnect between the possession of nuclear weapons and the idea of the deterrent and the actual use, which I think is very interesting.
That is
very interesting,
even though they're not involved in the decision at all, feeling like they're invested in Britain's nuclear weapons. Yeah,
definitely.
Where that comes from.
Britain has like 1% of the world's nuclear weapons, 250 weapons, and you just think that's frightening, right? Because it's a deterrent, but is it? Because we'd get absolutely annihilated anyway. But are we just going to think, oh, that's okay because I've killed all our enemies? They're not my enemies, they're the government's enemies, but I'm paying for that. So I just think it's really ridiculous, because everybody dies if somebody sets fire to a house down the road. You don't atone that and set fire to the whole city, do you?
Yeah, it's never going to be a proportionate reply to anything, is it?
It's very interesting, yeah, to see the different reasons students would give. It is often about defence, security. Mm. They say, you know, if we got rid of it, we'd be vulnerable. We're a small island. We need it. Some of them say, they would say, actually, if we did get attacked, I'd want to hit back. I'd want to retaliate.
Really?
For others, it's the case of, I'd never want to use it, but I want to know it's there.
Mm.
And others, it might be a different reason. So it's really, yeah, striking to see the range of views that they put across.
Would they want to go to heaven? I mean, if you go to a Church of England school, it raises that spiritual question, doesn't it? And that religious question that if you, like the bomb over Urakami, Nagasaki was dropped by God-fearing men, Christian men, and they feared rejection from their country and the patriotic virtue and the allegiance to that country more than defying the preachings of the Bible or any religion. I don't think any God at all would say, no, that's fine, that's very humane of you. Come into the gates.
I think the religious parallels are really important to draw out. We, in that Truman on Trial pack, we also have an RE lesson which looks at the theory of just war. We start off with getting the kids to decide for themselves which rules they would create or conditions for a war to be acceptable or just, and then they look at the actual sort of historical theory of just war and apply it then to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And again, they do tend to find that those bombings do not meet the criteria of the just war, although it's really interesting to see different points of view of that.
Sure.
Of course, these questions of faith. And indeed, Winston Churchill, as we refer to in the updated Truman on Trial pack, had his own qualms about his involvement in the bombings because he gave Britain's consent to Truman for them to go ahead with those bombings. And he did write later on, what will my maker say to me at the gates of heaven? And that's a really interesting kind of element of doubt that I think's quite valuable for students to explore. There's no parallel for Truman. Although there was, again, this is in our pack, an absolutely bizarre incident where Churchill was visiting Truman, I believe in the early 50s, and they were having a dinner at the White House, and Truman was actually asked by Churchill, what will you say to St. Peter about the bombs? And almost incredibly, it ended up in a role play where they literally put a trial on.
Oh, word.
I believe Truman played judge rather than the sort of defendant, and Churchill was in the defendant's seat and was ultimately acquitted. And all of this is recounted by Truman's daughter, but just an incredible sort of anecdote for us to let the students know.
Yeah.
What you're doing in this lesson did kind of happen, but in a bit of a tongue-in-cheek way.
Yeah, this is the game, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Something that I find sort of interesting and challenging in the classroom is that, so I think anyone listening to this podcast would know what we think about nuclear weapons by now, but going into the classroom, we're saying that we're enabling critical thinking. So how do you kind of manage that kind of balance of, like, you have your own views, but you're enabling young people to think for themselves about it?
One of our key criteria for any school speaker volunteers is that they are accepting of the fact that we have to present this in a balanced way. Then the emphasis is really giving the debate and giving the platform to the students. So we wouldn't usually give our own point of view. And it's an interesting discussion that I have both with our volunteers and with teachers that we train to deliver controversial issues, lessons in general. Would you give your own point of view? And if so, how would you do it? How would you manage it to make it appropriate? And some people say, I just wouldn't give it. Some people say, if a student asked me directly, I wouldn't want to cop out. I would say, but I'd couch it in very clear terms. This is my point of view. You obviously have yours, you may disagree.
But then you're modelling it as well, aren't you, of that kind of, we can disagree without it being...
Absolutely.
It's interesting that you ask that, though, because I've had this before. Lefties giving peace education lessons, blah, blah, blah. What are they doing going into schools, blah, 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 blah. What frustrates me is, in the Second World War, and to a degree even now, there is that propagated promotion of military.
Mm.
Like, look at Juden, the propaganda posters in the Second World War, with the spider going in the web, and the German Aryan, teaching in schools, hit the youths, etc., etc., etc. None of that was questioned, because there was an oppressive result at the end of that, which would have meant punishment. Whereas with peace education, it's almost like you have to justify peace education, but you don't have to justify, our people in tenements, the militarisation of the youth. That's not in question. For somebody to come out, the poppy, to make people feel bad at memorial ceremonies if they want to lay a white poppy wreath down, that there's quite an oppressive...
I think this discussion that we're having highlights why peace education is so important, because we're young people, but not just young people.
Mm.
We're almost, I say flooded, but it's kind of a norm when you say, like, militarization, things that we see every day around us, but we don't actually critically... I mean, I don't know how many people sit down at dinner and go, like, oh, I saw this poster today, or someone came into my school today and, spoke to me. But I think that's why it's so important to have peace education, because we're surrounded by these images and we're not always engaging and asking why we think something. So at least this gives the opportunity for young people especially to, like you said, to critically think about these issues. But yeah, I think what I draw from this is, it's peace education is so vital in today's current climate.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, we obviously focus on nuclear weapons issues, but I think our biggest contribution by far isn't actually to do with that, but it is that greater movement towards citizens who are well equipped to think independently about any issue and be able to interrogate some things that are told, which is obviously crucial in this epidemic of sort of fake news and false information that they're surrounded by. So that's, I think, at the key of peace education, at the core, I should say, of peace education for many people.
And look at the Darkest Hour film with Churchill recently. It's winning awards, it's getting people to feel very patriotic, which is great. That is really good, because it's been a bit of a downtime with Brexit as we relinquish, Europe. But, I sort of think can't have something like that that focuses on a man's achievements and not his crimes. You know, you can't. The world speaks British for a reason, because we were an empire, and we say that we're trying to find out what British values are, okay? But I mean, we're all coming down to, well, what are our British values then? Are we celebrating a man like Churchill, who, you know, basically 3 million Bengali staff that he could have helped? He looked away from them, but he looked towards them when he wanted them to fight the battle, his battle. You know, we're celebrating British values where nuclear test veterans don't even get compensation. Are we celebrating British values that... Are we being very selective with our British values? I think we are. We should be able to articulate as Churchill was in his rousing speeches, why we disagree with that notion of what we consider being British. If we consider being British being an MBE or an OBE with the word letter E at the end of it, empire... Is that offensive for a multicultural country? I find that very offensive. That is against human values. So
I think actually that also raises questions about the curriculum as well. Because I don't remember when I was at school engaging in these kind of debates. We did what we decide children should learn about, young people should learn about. And it also made me think about information today, how it's absorbing it. You look on your phone, there's news, you don't think as much because you're being flooded with things. So, no, it's really important for young people to be exposed to these issues, but also probably a good entry point to discuss the curriculum as well. And like, should this actually, instead of just calling an organisation in, actually, this needs to be part of history. We need to discuss this, not just as a small 5 minute, oh, nuclear weapons are bad.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I think as peace educators, we are currently doing something countercultural or something radical.
Exactly.
So peace is currently controversial, like you say, Anthony, but it doesn't need to be. So, but the curriculum, because it values certain narratives, certain points of view more.
Like, why is peace seen as controversial?
Well, I don't know. I know is that we've got more nuclear weapons in this country than we have hospitals. But CND, people, since I've become a patient, they were so surprised when I said that it consists of Owen. That's it.
In the peace education.
You know, we spend £120 billion on nuclear weapons, right? And what do we spend on weapons of mass instruction, right?
Nice.
That is a great phrase.
£100 grand a year, maybe, if that. You know, so just try and encourage people to say, become an educator with CND. It's the greatest gift you can give to people like school students. You're going to break the cycle, not fuel the problem.
We always seek to maximise our output by focusing on training the trainers via our teacher training sessions, you know, encouraging them to use our packs, download them, and also the packs in existence in themselves. That is the obviously greatest impact. We've had, you know, thousands of downloads. It's so encouraging. Occasionally a teacher will say, oh yeah, I've been doing the bomb factor in our assistantship sort of scheme of work for the last 3 years. And that's so wonderful to hear. And really, like, you think, okay, so we are having a bigger impact than we realise.
So Owen, if you are a student and you'd like CND peace education in your school, like to put Truman on trial in your classroom, or if you're a teacher and you'd like some of these resources, what should I do?
Well, we would absolutely love to hear from new teachers. So what you have to do is get in touch with us. The best way is probably to go on our website, which is www.cnduk.org/education. So that's www.cnduk.org/education. And you can find our contact details there. Just give us a ring or send us an email and we will get back to you.
I bet it's really expensive though, Aaron.
Well, in fact, it's completely free. The only thing that we sometimes ask for is travel expenses to be reimbursed, but if that's possible, that's great. If it's not, we will still come to the school. We are always keen to hear from new teachers, and we can tailor the sessions depending on the ages of the students, their abilities, the size of the group. Sometimes we do a whole day of sessions, sometimes we do a one-off session, sometimes somewhere in between.
Fabulous.
Please do get in touch.
Yeah, and we'll make sure that all those links are in the show notes as well. Anthony Owen Everett, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Thanks for having us.
So we're back here with Sadia, who works on peace and disarmament for Quakers in Britain. So Sadia, where are things at the moment in the whole conversation around nuclear disarmament?
It's a really exciting time. Last Friday, Colombia became the 60th state to sign the nuclear ban treaty.
That's amazing.
Yep, it's great. And here in the UK, Fabian Hamilton, the Shadow Minister for Peace and Disarmament, has signed the ICAM parliamentary pledge.
Which is?
So the ICAN Parliamentary Pledge, which we currently have up on our website, what it is an action where we're encouraging friends and others to write to their MP to push them to lobby the UK government to sign the nuclear ban treaty.
So it's like a pledge that parliamentarians take?
Yes.
to encourage the government to take?
Yeah.
So why is that important?
As we all know, the UK excused itself from discussions regarding the nuclear ban treaty at the UN. And it's not just important to focus on the foreign minister and the prime minister. It's really important that we mobilise support within parliament for the nuclear ban treaty, hence why the parliamentary pledge was designed.
As this presumably is also a useful tool if the Prime Minister was to change or the government was to change,
yeah.
To have that historic kind of commitment.
You can hold your MP or MSP to account.
You mentioned that there were 60 countries who've signed the nuclear ban treaty so far, which is really great news. What kind of brings all those countries together to sign it? Why have they decided to sign it?
So I think one of the things that has encouraged those countries to sign it is the nature of the ICAN movement. So it's diverse in terms of gender, race, you know, low-income countries, and so everyone feels like they have a stake and they're working towards the same goal. And we've spoken about this before within ICAN, about how it's really important to reframe the debate about nuclear weapons, nuclear disarmament, and to include groups that have traditionally been excluded. So not just low-income countries, but women and indigenous peoples. And there was a really great advocacy brief that I read recently from the Centre for Feminist Foreign Policy, which stated that nuclear tests have been carried out at more than 60 locations worldwide, often on the lands of indigenous and minority peoples, which begs the question, why were these people not involved in the debate from the beginning? Yeah, so I think there's a real sense of everyone coming together within the ICAN movement and, you know, engaging all countries and people, and also supporting countries in the South, global South, to do their own thing rather than be telling them what to do.
Mm-hmm. So kind of listening to those voices,
yeah,
of people that have been more affected.
Yeah.
Listening to the survivors from Hiroshima,
yeah,
and Nagasaki, listening to people from like the Marshall Islands where,
yeah,
tests happened.
So I would say a really good like example of something that ICAN is supporting is in September, where we've got the Nay Nukes rally, and we've got people from all over coming. We've got Iran, Iraq, who else? Lots of different countries, Korea. And there's been a real conscious effort to not just have the usual people or usual countries speaking about nuclear disarmament and nuclear weapons, but,
mm-hmm,
to reach out and to involve others. And if we want, I think, to be more diverse, we do really need to think about the people that we're inviting to come and speak about the issues, to inform us.
Do they bring different stories then? That...
Yeah, so I think one of the things we have to remember as well, we look at nuclear weapons, but we also have to remember the different contexts as well. As I mentioned about the gendered and racial, you know, making it more diverse, we need to listen to people who've been affected by nuclear weapons, or directly affected, and bring them into the debate.
If those voices and stories are so important, I'm particularly thinking of a couple of different things there. First of all is how many of that generation that were affected by, particularly,
yeah,
Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you know, that generation is sort of leaving us now.
Mm.
And also, like, how do you capture and share those stories? I don't think always, certainly the testing and the use of nuclear weapons,
yeah,
seems like something really in the past to a lot of people, particularly my generation.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you
have
any thoughts on that?
I think when I said about reframing the debate, I think that is the point of reframing the debate, not just to acknowledge and recognise the gendered and racial impacts, but also, if we want to push for more like progressive disarmament initiatives, we need to be talking about these things, and we need to be thinking about the audiences that we're talking about this issue with. I was at a ceremony to commemorate Hiroshima Day. One of the speakers, called Nobu, who was from Japan, spoke about how he felt the message, the younger people did not know enough about nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament, and that we weren't really doing enough to engage them in the debate, and that it was great that all of us there knew about them, but what were we doing to spread the message? Because,
mm-hmm,
that's the most important thing. And I think that's also where like technology comes in as well, like how thinking of innovative ways to pass down these messages. So yes, it may be through people speaking, but also looking at the different mediums we can use to like communicate the message.
I think some of the most moving things that I've seen have been animations of the stories of people who survived the nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And just the way that the animations were done really helped tell the story in quite a moving and powerful way, but often in quite a simple way as well that was really understandable, to really paint a picture of that scene.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, like particularly for young people. I mean, if we think about peace education, nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament aren't really discussed a lot. And if we are going to do that, we need to think about the way. So something like an animation is something that is going to engage, more than likely engage young people. So I think we have to think about how we spread the message and engage.
And as people were saying in the conversation, both Anthony Owen and Ellis were all saying about how important it was to make sure that people felt like they could be part of this conversation, that it isn't just about people telling young people what to do or what to think about things, but giving them enough information to be able to come to their own conclusions about things as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important. You have to have critical thinking on the issue as well. So I think what's important is that the people who are campaigning, I say back in the day, who are campaigning, it's not that what they did or, you know, is not relevant. It's about how do you link what happened with what's going on today. I think that is a really important thing, and you can do that in so many ways. One of the things that I really liked at the Hiroshima Day commemoration was that there weren't just speakers, there was dance. So they had dancers who interpreted what it may have been like on the day. But it was quite innovative, and we had readings, and then in the evening we had a film screening, which I attended. So in one day you saw so many different ways of engage people at all levels. And I think we really have to remember that not everybody starts off on the same. Part of the education about nuclear weapons, nuclear disarmament, is raising awareness. We're not all starting off with the same knowledge.
And do you think that conversation is bubbling up again a bit now? Because my experience is, it sort of, when I was growing up, nuclear weapons was kind of like a historic thing, and we had them, but oh, we were never going to need to use them, and it's just a thing that we have. And then, you know, when we were talking about, you know, Japan, it was always in the context of kind of, oh, you know, it was probably a bad thing, but on the other hand, it was just such a kind of historical. And suddenly I feel like global politics in the last few years has made it really roar again. I don't know if you found that.
I would agree
people
with that.
People joke about Trump and the nuclear button, but at least it's got a lot of people thinking about this debate again.
I think that, with Trump, I think this debate has come to the fore. So there is an opportunity to engage people who have never been engaged in this debate. And I think that you said about it, you know, you viewing it as, or it being viewed as something like a historic issue. I think the fact that you've got all these countries that you mentioned, like, how does that affect the debate as well and what's going on? The fact that you've got all these different countries signed up to it, I think it also allows you to reframe the debate and to start talking about gender and race. It provides an avenue. So,
and this is something that's been a long time in the process as well. So certainly for these countries that don't have nuclear weapons, the debate is ongoing.
Exactly.
I'm sure it was here as well.
No, I think I think that's actually true what you say. I think what it's really important to remember is those countries and the groups I mentioned, women, indigenous peoples, low-income countries, this is not something that they've just discovered or just started talking about. It's something that they've been probably talking about for a very, very, very long time. Now there's been like an opportunity for them to actually voice. And I think it's really important that we don't take that voice away, that you, like, as they say, pass the mic, and we allow them to speak and inform us actually about nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament, because, you know, no one knows everything.
If people are feeling really motivated to take action on this issue, how do they go about that?
I would say that it's really important for you to write to your MP regarding the parliamentary pledge. We have had people say to us, oh, I've written to my MP, MSP, but there's power in numbers. So the more people in a constituency that write to their MP and urge them to sign the parliamentary pledge, it's going to be more powerful. So that would be my call to action.
Cool.
Thanks, Andrea. And
thank you for being on the podcast.
In the last episode of series 2 of the podcast, we asked people what they were reading, and people really seemed to like that section, so we thought we'd keep it in for this newly revamped Quaker Take. So Sadia, what are you reading at the moment?
I always like to know what people are reading. So I've been reading The Advocacy Briefs by the Centre for Feminist Foreign Policy, which
sounds really intellectual.
But they are really, one of the reasons why I like them is because they're really simple. So they introduce you to a topic, like a page, and it's really easy to digest the information.
Where are they from?
The Centre for Feminist Foreign Policy, which you can have a look at online.
Cool. Is there another book you're reading at the moment?
The book I'm reading at the moment is called Barracoon, and it's about one of the last people who were shipped as a slave from Africa to the US. It's not a long read, but it's a very good read.
Great.
John, what are you reading?
Well, I'm reading a book called Millennium, which is not relevant to any of this really, which is about the turn of the first millennium, the year 1000, and it's very interesting, just the history and kind of how important Christianity is, but also watching Christianity get kind of like distorted a bit. And so, yeah, I'm up to a bit about the Vikings, where they're all becoming Christian, but still doing Viking things. And it's very interesting.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
It does.
It's a bit intense, but it's good.
Okay.
And you?
I'm currently 2/3 of the way through Trans Britain. And yeah, it's just one of those books where I feel like I've learnt quite a lot in a really easy, digestible way about the story around sort of trans recognition in this country and where that whole conversation is at the moment. And it seems very sort of pertinent for now, which is kind of why I wanted to know more. I wanted to learn a bit more about that story. So I'm finding it quite an engaging book with different stories from different people and how they were affected. So.
I think there's a bookshop event, isn't there?
So the Quaker Centre Bookshop is hosting an event with the editor of this book all about this topic, and it's going to be on the 4th of September in London, but it will also be live streamed as well on Facebook. So if people are also interested in that book, they can have a listen to that.
Excellent. So I think that about wraps it up for our first episode of Quaker Take.
Feel free to share your comments and feedback with us on Twitter or on Facebook, and thank you for listening to this episode of A Quaker Take.
Yep, and tune in next month, where we're going to be talking about God. It's going to be great.
Yeah, Quaker Take on God.
Quaker Take on God. What could go wrong? It's going to be great.